is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again. Welcome to the Country Hour. Coming up, we'll talk about koalas and also a leading Australian farming family is caught up in a land deal that the Auditor General says may have seen the Commonwealth defrauded. You might have some thoughts about that. You can send us a text here at the Country Hour 0467 922 684, and also the issue of koalas as well. You can always send us a text on that 0467 922 684. That's the number to text us here at the Country Hour. But first up today, the federal government has ruled out introducing an illegal worker amnesty that would have allowed undocumented workers to come forward without fear of deportation. Western Australia's Agriculture Minister, Alana McTiernan, supported the amnesty after Victorian Agriculture Minister Jacqueline Symes raised the idea at a meeting of ag ministers earlier this year. Federal Agriculture Minister David Littleproud said his government was considering it in the light of COVID-19 restrictions that have prevented foreign workers from entering the country. But last night, before a Senate estimates hearing, Employment Minister Senator Michaelia Cash ruled it out.
The position of the government is very clear. An amnesty would send a dangerous message that it's okay to flout our strong visa and migration rules. Principles that this government has worked incredibly hard over a period of time to secure. The government is very clear in its position. There will be no amnesty.
And in response, the Victorian Farmers Federation Vice President Emma Germana was very angry, and this is a direct quote from her. She said that farmers were pissed off that they had pretended to look at it when they never had genuine intention of actually making this thing go through. Instead, the federal government support a black market for horticultural wages that undermines the farmers that are compliant and the ones that pay the right wages. You can see more about that story online. It's just been breaking this morning. 0467 922 684 is a number to text me at the Country Hour, and also you can get more online at abc.net.au/rural. It's 8 minutes past 12.
You're listening to the Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
To that land deal, and a leading Australian farming family is caught up in a land deal that the Auditor General says may have seen the Commonwealth defrauded in the process, and the matter has now been referred to the Australian Federal Police. The Perich family sold a parcel of land in 2018, now being called the Leppington Triangle, to the federal government's infrastructure department for $30 million. A year later, it was valued at just $3 million. David Claughton's been watching the story, and I asked him what we know so far about the deal.
Well, the deal is just for 12 hectares of land, which will be at the end of the runway for this planned Western Sydney Airport, which is still probably a couple of decades away. And it's a small parcel of land. They've bought quite a lot of land the state government has anyway in that area. So this is just a crucial bit at the end. The issue here is around the money that the Federal Infrastructure Department paid for this triangle of land called the Leppington Triangle. Only one valuation of it was made, and it was by a company, MJ Davis Valuations, that was suggested by the family that owned the property, which is the Leppington Pastoral Company, the Perich family. And the issue here, I suppose, is there was only one valuation done. Evidently, the valuer couldn't get on the property. He just had to do a drive-by. There are questions about that valuation, particularly given there were a number of other valuations that were made between 2017 and June 2019. And their highest valuation was about $6 million. Well, the government ended up paying $30 million. So there are big questions around how much was paid and what the minister was told. Now, at the time, the minister was Paul Fletcher, and he says he wasn't told what the final price, the sale price, was for this 12 hectares of land. And there is support coming from other parts of the government around this. Some people, like the Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack, saying that in time this deal will be regarded as a bargain. But the Auditor General, Grant Hehir, says that the information was suggestive of the fact that the Commonwealth may have been defrauded.
So there'll now be an AFP investigation?
Well, he's referred the matter to the AFP and suggesting that there are potentially some criminal offences relating to the sale. Grant Hehir was in Senate estimates in the last day or so, and he said it's the first time that he's ever contacted the AFP about doing an audit. He said he felt the department didn't exercise due diligence on its purchase, and that the agency's, this is the agency, the infrastructure department, their operations fell short of some ethical standards. But that will ultimately be a matter for the AFP to decide. Internally, the department's saying that two of their staff in the department's Western Sydney unit are being investigated, and one's been moved to another role, one's been stood down. Infrastructure Department Secretary Simon Atkinson told a Senate committee he had serious concerns about how it was handled. He wanted to clean it up, in his own words, and he commissioned three internal inquiries into the deal. But the Auditor General is really saying that the department didn't demonstrate the benefits of acquiring or paying for the land some decades in advance of when it, when it was needed, and really questioned the price that the Australian government had to pay. And he came to the view that the information that he'd had found couldn't explain and was suggestive of the fact that Commonwealth may have been defrauded. So I guess the AFP will have to make their own investigations and decide whether there is, in fact, any criminality in that.
So now the property has been leased back to the family for 10 years. What do we know about the Perich family?
Well, they were on the Forbes rich list in 2019, and they've been on the rich list for quite a while. They were sitting at number 22 of the top 50. Ron and Tony Perich have assets at that time supposedly of $1.75 billion. And their son, Michael, runs the family farming operation. I met a couple of them earlier this year. You might recall that story where they donated $1 million to the New South Wales Farmers Bushfire Fund. And they're the sons of Croatian immigrant parents. So that really, this is a fantastic story in a way of an immigrant family that bought some land in Western Sydney, started with 25 cows, and have built it up now to a herd that's 2,000 strong. So they're a farming family. They own the Leppington Pastoral Company, but now most of their money would come from property. They have a Greenfields property development company that's selling more than 12,500 lots, housing lots in Western Sydney. And they also own a controlling share in Freedom Foods. So they are a big business, a very successful farming family. And they will continue to farm this land under a leaseback arrangement for the next 10 years with an option for another 10 years. But there is concern about a deal they've made with the state government to spend $10 million on an underpass that will give them access to the farm over that period of time.
And are they commenting at all about this?
Look, they've only made a statement to say that they would fully cooperate with any investigation. And to quote from that statement, Leppington Pastoral Company has acted appropriately at all times in relation to this property transaction. And to restate what I said earlier, there isn't any suggestion that they've done anything wrong.
And so who is being investigated? Is the Minister, Paul Fletcher, being investigated? Are the staff members being investigated? Do we know that?
All that we know at this stage is that the Government Infrastructure Department, the federal one, is conducting some internal investigations. The auditor has looked at the way that things were handled and has raised questions about the process. They would and has referred that matter to the AFP. And then it's up to the AFP to decide whether there are actually any criminal charges that might stem from that. But it relates to ethical or unethical behaviour and whether the Commonwealth has been defrauded.
And also, I guess that if it has been defrauded, then the question is where the money, the fraudulent money went.
Well, I think money's gone to the Leppington Pastoral Company, but I suppose there may be questions about whether anybody else benefited from that transaction.
David Claughton reporting there. It's 12:15.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, controversial amendments to the state's koala protection policy are due to go before the Parliament's lower house tomorrow. The move follows a pretty spectacular blow-up between the Nationals and their coalition partners in the Liberal Party a few weeks ago. Of course, we know that a compromise was eventually reached. and farmers say they're happier with the deal, but not everyone is happy. Greens MP Kate Fairman, who chaired a parliamentary inquiry into the koala habitat, today hosted an online hookup featuring a number of conservation groups in a bid to muster some opposition. And ABC reporter Bruce McKenzie tuned in. He joins us now. Good afternoon.
G'day.
So what was the main concern raised?
Well, basically, Kate Fairman, as you mentioned, she chaired this parliamentary inquiry into koala populations and their habitat. And she basically thinks that the findings of that and the recommendations of that inquiry, although initially accepted, have now been ignored in the name of a compromise between the two coalition partners. And she says it's not so much a compromise as a massive step backwards for koala protection. You know, the figure being bandied about for potential koala extinction in the state is 2050. She was saying that if this actually gets through in its current form, that we could see extinction well before that particular date. So she's basically... this was a background briefing for any state MPs that wanted to tune in to get a bit more information, and obviously she also invited the media to tune in as well.
And who spoke to the online event?
Well, one of the first people we heard from was Rachel Walmsley. Now, she's a policy and law reform director at the Environmental Defenders Office. And she made the point that, well, in her opinion, that the key changes being proposed under this amendment to the bill assume that robust protections exist for koalas. And she said, we need to be clear, they do not. And she says what is being proposed goes against the recommendations of a myriad of government departments. And here's just a little bit of what she had to tell this briefing.
So there's a range of changes made to the guideline and the CEF as a result of the capitulation by the government recently. But in terms of this actual bill, what it's doing is weakening land clearing laws against all the evidence and the recommendations that have said you need to strengthen land clearing laws. So I'll just finish with a quote from the Audit Office. This is what they said last year. They found the clearing of native vegetation on rural land is not effectively regulated and managed because the processes in place to support the regulatory framework are weak. There is no evidence-based assurance that clearing of native vegetation is being carried out in accordance with approvals. Responses to incidents of unlawful clearing are slow with few tangible outcomes. Enforcement action is rarely taken against landholders who unlawfully clear native vegetation. There are processes in place for approving land clearing. There's limited follow-up to ensure approvals are complied with. So basically we have regulatory failure, we have open slather for clearing, and what this bill is doing is allowing further exemptions and further clearing in koala habitat.
So that was Rachel Walmsley, and she's from the Environmental Defenders Office, Michael.
Now, we also have heard from farmers that they had concerns about issues like mapping, and also they said there was inconsistency. Some of those changes have been made in regards to this compromise that's been reached, but there's also been issues about the number of koalas that there are on private land, particularly in the north of the state. So that certainly has been an issue that farmers have been talking about as well. What other issues stood out today in the briefing you heard, Bruce?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, the number of koalas on private land. We heard from Dylan Pugh, who's from the North East Forest Alliance. He came armed with plenty of facts and figures and visual aids, as he tends to do. He told the briefing that on the North Coast, 61% of high-quality koala habitat actually occurs on private property. And so one of his concerns was in the realm of private native forestry. He was saying that there's more than 4,670,000 hectares are approved for private native forestry across the state, and 95% of that is on the North Coast. He also raised some concerns about koala plans of management, which we know only a handful of councils across the state have managed to get approved. He worries whether they will have any teeth into the future and whether any councils will bother doing them from this point on. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Just really frightening, really. Once they give these approvals for logging they're going to do for 30 years, the local government can't do anything about it. If you're building a house, you've got to get approval, you've got to go through all these steps. If you're clearing and logging hundreds of hectares, you don't need to do any approval except from this shoddy process the government requires, which provides no real protection. So really, this is all about gutting protections for the koalas and the koala steps being gutted and made virtually useless. I personally really can't see much point now in any council preparing a koala plan and management to identify poor koala habitat. You've got all these hoops to jump through, and then there's all these outs once you do it.
So that was Dylan Pugh from NEFA, the North East Forest Alliance.
And of course, Bruce, the koala protection policy goes before the Parliament's lower house tomorrow, so we'll be watching it pretty closely.
Indeed, and I reckon you'll be watching your text line fairly closely for the next 40 minutes or so too, Michael. Yeah, good luck with that.
Getting a few texts coming through already. All right, thanks for that, Bruce.
Pleasure.
That's Bruce McKenzie from ABC News on the North Coast. You're listening to The Country Hour, 21 minutes past 12.
The Country Hour.
On ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, let's turn our attention to shearing now, because shearers and wool handlers from New Zealand can now travel to Australia quarantine-free and get straight to work on spring shearing. However, it's expected that only a very few are going to make the trip, as they'll have to quarantine when they return home to New Zealand, and they'll also have to pay a large fee to do so, and then they'll be delayed going to help out shearing over the ditch as well. Shearing Contractors Association of Australia Secretary Jason Letchford explains more about this continuing shortage of shearers.
Unfortunately, Cara, it'll be down to handfuls and dozens at best. So as we've previously spoken about, we identified that about 480 New Zealand workers, without counting the European workers, come to Australia for the spring. We're halfway through spring, you know, on the tail end of it. And now, even with the opening of that Trans-Tasman bubble, well, it's really just a one-way ticket to New South Wales. At best, I can say, is handfuls. Shearing contractors all over the country are calling New Zealand if they've got relationships with, you know, shearers, saying, you know, there's plenty of work here for, you know, easily 6 months' worth of work ahead of them to come on over. But my feedback is, if there's a strong relationship between that shearing contractor and those one or two and three workers here and there, then that's happening. But it's very much limited because of the fact that, you know, New Zealand hasn't opened up the quarantine. It's not quarantine free to return. There's still a $3,000 price tag to return. So it's very limited. You can't have any commitments back in New Zealand with your shearing contractor or family or friends in order to even consider coming over. So, you know, to reiterate, it's very few that will be jumping on that aeroplane.
The flight that came in where people dispersed through into Victoria, do you know if any of them went into working in shearing sheds or who they were?
Yeah, anecdotally, I know that there was shearers and shearing shed staff on those early flights to come into there. And I suppose we're a little bit bemused by, you know, the Premier of Victoria's comments that it was unbeknownst to him that people would come through Sydney and go straight to Victoria. There was nothing illegal or, you know, incorrect about doing that. That was certainly, they followed the process. They were sponsored by their employer. They got the correct permits. And I think those workers and those people should have been applauded for making the effort to get here as quickly and as soon as they can, as opposed to being, you know, poo-pooed by the Premier that people are actually trying to come into the state and do, you know, and keep their economy going. So anyway, I believe that the Premier's changed his tune, and I know they have a lot on their plate, so it's hard to sort of accuse people of doing the wrong thing. But it's the bottom line is it's good news that gateway is now at least open, even though it's only a trickle at the moment.
And so those shearers, are they already in sheds working in Victoria, to the best of your knowledge?
They would be, because there was no quarantining, as we all know, no isolating, and they just needed to jump off the plane in Tullamarine and have the correct permits, which the employers could certainly raised for them, and they were in their vehicles heading out to jobs, you know, presumably starting work this morning.
When they return back there to New Zealand, they'd have to quarantine for 2 weeks, is my understanding, and shearing does kick off in December back in New Zealand primarily, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. That in the past, the ones that came here for spring generally would, you know, show a loyalty to their employer back in New Zealand and need to be back home there by, as you said, the 1st of December. So you really, you know, given that there's 2 weeks that they'd need to quarantine, you know, we've only got like a week and a half left of this month. At best, they'd be here for 3 weeks if they were going to fulfil their, you know, return home commitment. By the time, you know, you pay for airfares and the $3,100 to quarantine over there, you know, it's obviously something that's not going to happen for any of those workers with those commitments.
And so how are Australian wool growers getting on at the moment with that, I guess, lack of shearers, supply, border restrictions, things throughout this corona period? How are they getting through spring shearing?
Well, really badly, I'll say. they're weeks. Anyone who's got a bigger flock that generally employs a shearing contractor, you know, let's call them the bigger guys around, then they're always an attractive proposition from both the employer and the employee's perspective when you get a good run of sheep in a shed. You know, there's money to be made, so to speak. The ones that I really feel for at the moment are the what we call cocky farmers, just the mum and dad farmers out there that have hundreds and maybe the low thousands of sheep that would generally do the work themselves, ring the local shearer, and he or she will organise, you know, a couple of their shearing mates, and they'll come and do those jobs. They at the moment, I believe, are very few and far between. The shearing contractors have certainly, you know, thrown the carrot to those workers to have a good, consistent run of work. So, you know, every South Australia, Vic, New South Wales, those smaller operators are desperate at the moment, and they just have there's no end date in sight for them. I mean, the sheep will get shorn, but they've got no vision. You know, shearing contractors and shearers are, you know, struggling to return their call for the reason that they've got no good answer to give them.
It's been widely spoken about. There's plenty of people looking for work at the moment, but shearing isn't just a skill that anybody can pick up straight away. Have you heard of anyone keen to get into shearing at the moment?
Cara, that's been certainly the silver lining. We operate an RTO for shearing in Victoria and South Australia and have the contract over there to do the shearer training over there. And our manager over there, Glenn Haynes, he's reported that we're probably by Christmas we'll have 100 new entrants into the market that are learning shearing. And most of those, you know, there'll be a high percentage of those that will continue into the industry. So going back to that, you know, 480, 500 that we've identified as seasonal workers. Well, we've made a bit of an impact into that, and those workers obviously will be around and bring their skills up. But it really takes, you know, 6 months to sort of get yourself, you know, doing what you'd call like the minimum, which is around 75 a day. And clearly there's, you know, exceptions that the workers will come on and do that faster, but some take longer. But yeah, look, it's certainly not a case of, you know, being introduced to a handpiece and you being able to apply that skill to get the wool off the sheep in a safe and commercial way. So that does take thing. You know, shed hands, as you know, still a skill there, but we can certainly bring those workers from outside the industry up to speed much faster.
Shearing Contractors Association of Australia Secretary Jason Letchford speaking there to Cara Jeffrey. You're listening to The Country. I got quite a few texts, as Bruce McKenzie predicted, quite a few texts on the koala issue. We've got a text from Steve at Inverell. He sent us a picture of a koala in a tree, saying it was a visitor to the local school. The kids at the local Gum Flat Public see quite a few koalas, he said, and he says we need diverse ecology. Also, Lil from Nambucca says it's depressing listening to about the threats to our endangered koala population when so many of us want to protect them and the forests that they live in. But Dave from Wee War is saying, give us your land or the koalas get it. How typically green is that, he says. Dave accuses them of always eroding liberties and imposing burdens by creating a fear of losing something precious. And there's a few other texts about the Leppington Triangle. Terry from Coonabarabran, I think he's trying to be humorous here. He's saying the story about the Leppington Triangle is about to take off and it might be terminal for someone's employment. I wonder how long they've been waiting in the wings, says Terry. So there you go, with reference to the airport there, no doubt. It's coming up to 12:30 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Shortly, we'll be hearing about Norco record price, and record price because of a pretty good profit there for the dairy processor Norco, and the price has gone up to more than 70 cents per litre. So we'll be hearing about that shortly on the program. But before we do anything else, he's waiting in the wings. Adam Story with news headlines. Good afternoon.
You've got the new news.
I won't live that down, will I?
Good.
I'm in trouble now.
Yeah.
Yes. What's coming up in the news?
Well, so you want to know what's coming up, not what's happened now. Oh, jeez, come on.
I can't win, can I? I'm
supposed to predict what's going to happen this afternoon. All right. Look, there's good news in Victoria with just one case reported overnight and no further deaths. And that one case that was reported, they're saying that could be an old infection and could actually be removed from the state's daily tally today. So that would mean they actually have zero cases, which is a big day for celebration in Victoria. New South Wales has reported two new cases, but they're locally transmitted cases as well, but they are linked to known clusters. A man has been arrested and is expected to be charged with murder. It was after a woman was found dead in the driveway of her home in Como in Sydney's south overnight, and it's believed the man is the woman's ex-partner. The US presidential candidates Donald Trump and Joe Biden will have their microphones turned off for segments of this week's final pre-election debate. The Commission on Presidential Debates has changed the rules after the first encounter was widely criticised when the moderator lost control. I don't know whether turning the mics off will be enough.
Shout him down. Yeah. Or do what he, Trump might do what he did with Hillary and just walk behind her.
And then make hand gestures. And back home, the heavy metal singer Dee Snider has appeared in a Sydney court via video link. He's suing Clive Palmer over the use of the track We're Not Gonna Take It. And Dee Snider was asked by the legal team for Clive Palmer. He said, "Oh, don't you think that the promotion of the song by Clive Palmer would help Dee Snider's upcoming tour of Australia?" To which he responded, "No, he wouldn't, because the rendition of the song was awful." And the message was misrepresented. But he did acknowledge that the track, the actual melody of the track, was inspired by O Come All Ye Faithful.
Yeah, I heard that. That was interesting. Yeah, if you think about it, you can hear it. Yeah, that's right.
Indeed,
yeah.
O Come All Ye Faithful.
Yeah,
similar. My old man hated that song.
Right.
Oh, not O Come All Ye Faithful. he loved a Christmas carol. he hated We're Not Gonna Take. He thought that would, you know, the world's
that was the end.
Would rebel,
right,
and
okay.
That would be the end of society.
Well, it is a bit repetitive.
You listen to it now, it's like Mary had a little lamb. It doesn't exactly inspire rebellion.
No, that's right. Yeah. Quite right. All right, well, thanks for that. So
more
we'll be listening.
Discussion there might
be,
the country,
there might be something new coming up at 1 o'clock. You might have some,
I may have some new
news.
You never know.
Yeah. We'll have to be listening
and
to find
a prediction
out.
Of what's going
to
happen.
All right. Okay, Adam's story there with music news, all sorts of things, entertainment news. You're listening to The Country Hour. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details now. David Wilkie's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you going?
Very well. Welcome to the Country Hour. So what's coming up with this rain? Because a lot of people are concerned about their crops in various areas and they don't really want a lot of rain on them. So we're going to see much coming through in the next few days?
Yeah. So it does look like quite a rainy pattern that we're moving into. I guess the main story really is we've got a trough. We've got a couple of troughs. We've got one that's really developing over the sort of northern inland around the New England region. So, tomorrow, Thursday, we'll probably see some reasonable storm activity up in that part of the world. Probably some good storms actually across most of the east, but there is a risk we'll see some severe storms and some bursts of heavier rainfall up in the northern inland and northeast tomorrow and Thursday. So I think totals generally for those couple of days, typically about 5 to 15 millimetres. But we could see some locally higher totals, I mean, as you always do with thunderstorms. So upwards of 40 millimetres on both days for kind of the New England northern tablelands.
But again, that won't be everywhere. It's just sort of a bit hit and miss.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I think as you head further south and over the central tablelands, a bit less likely to see those reasonable totals for tomorrow and Thursday. But then, really, as we move into Friday and Saturday, we're starting to see an inland trough move across from the west and upper feature, which is probably going to bring some pretty widespread thunderstorm activity and some rain. So I think really we're looking at reasonable rainfall, particularly on Saturday across a fairly broad area of New South Wales. So particularly on and west of the ranges, where I think on Saturday, I think expecting, you know, somewhere in the range of 20 to 40 millimetres on and west of the ranges, but locally sort of 50 to 60 could happen on that day. It does look like quite a wet situation, and I guess these sorts of patterns are what we expect with the kind of climate drives we have now, given we're in a La Nina. And really, the outlook for the next week, yeah, it sounds like it's probably not the best for listeners, because it does look quite rainy and quite stormy, particularly as we head into tomorrow. And for the next week, it looks like a chance of thunderstorms, particularly heading up towards the northeast for much of the next week.
So northeast and northwest as well. Not much for the central west, not much for the Riverina.
I think probably the Riverina, central west, could see some storms more likely as we head into Friday, Saturday. Should start to clear out as we head into Sunday, but really, I mean, it is that sort of stormy pattern where you can get storms. And if you get an isolated thunderstorm, it can still bring some decent rain. So I think, Friday and Saturday for those parts, central west and the Riverina, probably look like the rainier days.
Mm.
But again, it does depend on storms.
Sounds like it might be quite humid as well, too, while this system is sort of sitting there.
Yeah, that's right. So it's basically this trough just parked there, and it's bringing all that sort of moisture in from the Tasman. So the next couple of days are the build-up, where we just get that in-feed of humid air, and then, when we get the feature move through, the trough move through on Friday, Saturday, it's all primed, ready to go.
And what about early next week? Is it going to warm up? We're going to have some sunny days, so people can get into harvest?
I think as we move into sort of the next, the new week, probably immediately see some cooler temperatures behind that system moving in. Not great news at this stage. Temperatures we're forecasting as we move into kind of the new week in the west of the state, kind of mid to high 20s on the Monday, or actually probably about mid 20s on the Monday, a bit cooler, mid to high 20s on Tuesday, and then maybe starting to heat up as we move into the remainder of the week. But it is a little bit far to tell at this stage.
It's a bit too far out of the forecast period. All right, David, thanks for that.
Thank you.
David Wilkie at the Bureau there. It's 22 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
On the Leppington issue, we've had a few texts. Greg says he's concerned about corruption. He says farmers, developers, big business with the blessing from the Nationals. He says we should leave Gladys alone and focus on that deal. And on koalas, Brad at Grafton, South Grafton, says the attacks on koala populations will never be forgotten. The National and Liberal politicians who are facilitating the koala extinction will face torrid and protected action to ensure that they're not elected again. And there's a few more texts coming through. We'll get to them a little bit later on in the program. In fact, on the shearing issue, Phil has texted through on that issue as well. He says, why don't we train low-risk prisoners and wayward youths to train in the wool industry? The prisoners could make some handy money learning a new skill and also improve their self-esteem. That one from Phil. It's 21 minutes to one on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, to dairy now, and dairy processor Norco has announced a net profit of $5.4 million for the last financial year. That's up $1.2 million. The 125-year-old dairy cooperative also paid its suppliers in northern New South Wales and southern Queensland a record price for the year, with an average of more than 70 cents per litre of milk. Norco CEO Michael Hampson says all parts of the business improved quite significantly, and he told Kim Honan that the co-op increased its value by $21.3 million for its farmers.
A lot of that value was passed directly through to them to assist them through the effects of what was, you know, an incredibly crippling drought.
Well, it certainly has been a very tough year with the drought, the fires, the pandemic. What have been the main challenges that the cooperative and your supplier members have faced over the last 12 months?
It's funny. We take it for granted every day that we can go to the supermarket to get 2 litres of milk, but you know, there's hundreds of families that have gone out and taken on hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt to feed livestock whilst we've been able to do that. And that's been the most critical thing for our farmers is having to, you know, first source the feed, but then being able to fund the feed that they've had to feed their animals. And that debt's not going to go in, you know, 3 months after rains, of course. I mean, it's going to be a fair amount of time there for our members and the broader industry to be able to adjust back from that, you know, that quite significant drought.
And the operating profit for the year, you're reporting $5.4 million, and that's four times last year.
Yeah, so we started our change journey in the management team last year, towards the end of the last financial year, which we got some of the benefits in the last financial year. But over the course of this year, we've really changed the approach, what we've concentrated on, to make sure that we're delivering value in everything that we do, which has been seen some significant improvements in the business, which is a credit to the management team and all the employees at Norco that have worked really hard to get the result for the farmers to help them through the drought, but also to help build their business too, because a strong cooperative will mean a strong bunch of farmers as well, because when the next drought comes along, if we're stronger, we'll be able to provide even more support.
So a record price for farmers this year, you're reporting that?
For the last financial year, that's the highest price that the cooperative's ever paid in its 125th year.
Well, how much did farmers receive in that financial year period?
Just over 70 cents a litre on average. There'll be some farms that will be less, of course, and there's some farms that receive much more based on their component qualities of their milk. So on average, it's just over 70 cents a litre.
And how does that compare to some of the other processors in the industry who might be saying they're paying farmers more than that?
Look, in terms of the major processes, I mean, from our internal analysis, we haven't seen any other prices that have been higher. There might be some smaller processes that maybe that are, but certainly from where we sit in where we collect our milk from, we think that we have an incredibly strong and competitive milk price and provide really good value for the farmers and their milk.
It's been a very difficult year, Australia's relationship with China. Has that affected your exports there at all?
In terms of relationship-wise, Kim, no, I wouldn't. I mean, what's been difficult, of course, which we're not alone here, is our milk's obviously a fresh product that needs to be air freighted from Sydney to Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, places like that. So the availability of flights has probably been the major issue for us. The Norco brand's quite, you know, it was the first Australian brand that went into China. You know, we've got a fairly good following in China itself. We've just done some work with Walmart in China, and we're going into their stores as well now. So we're still seeing some good activity in that space. But with the reduced amount of planes flying between the two capitals of the two countries, that obviously creates some logistical challenges more than anything.
Michael Hampson is the CEO of Norco. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 17 minutes to one. Well, we were talking about crops earlier, and in fact, we've been reminded about the rain. Alan at Kuta reminding us, and I knew this would be the case as well, he's saying, contrary to me, hoping for no rain for the croppers, he says, the graziers in the Riverina and southwest slopes could do with about 200 millimetres, he says, as it's been a very dry spring so far. And yes, Alan, I know that there are some people out there that wanted a bit more rain. So that's a reminder from Alan that some of that rain hopefully would be pretty welcome in parts of the Riverina and elsewhere in the state. But the croppers don't want any at the moment. It's 16 minutes to one because, talking about that issue, a Coonamble farmer says rain over the weekend has already delayed his harvest plans And he says farmers in his district are hoping that the rain stays away to avoid any further crop damage. Tom Cullen farms barley and he started stripping the grain on Saturday before 14 millimetres of rain started falling. He says bumper crops are making the stripping of the grain slow and difficult.
Yeah, looking pretty good. We're just really keen to get going harvest-wise, obviously with the weather coming. Yeah, we're probably nearly there, I suppose. Crops are just about ripe, ready to go. But the problem we're finding in a lot of people up here is the straw's still quite green and it's really hard to thresh. So we're actually, hooked into it on Saturday, but only going about that sort of 3 to 4K an hour. It's just painfully slow. So hopefully that sort of ripens up a bit and we can get cracking on it once the ground dries up after this rain.
So the rain started on Saturday and you got about 14 mil. What does that mean for you now?
Yeah, it won't do any damage, but it just means that I suppose we just got to pull up now. Hopefully that rain might even bring the crops in a bit quicker. So we're just hoping that wheat and barley's ready to go. Maybe tomorrow lunchtime we'll give it a crack.
Fingers crossed. How's the forecast looking for you as well?
It's a little bit worrying. So if we get started tomorrow lunch, I think there's rain forecast for Wednesday night through to Sunday. And it's pretty worrying because there's quite a bit of rain in that forecast. And if things stay wet for long enough, we could get some crop damage. And we haven't even really started harvest. So it would be very disappointing if that happens. But fingers crossed we don't get the amount of rain that would cause that.
And how much more difficult would it make your life as well if you actually had a wet harvest?
It'd just be a few more hurdles to jump, I suppose. It'd just slow us down. And this is the crop that everyone is really, really keen to get off after 3 years of drought. We know the yield's there. We know the quality's there. It'd just be lower quality and less returns. And it's just something we don't really need this year.
And how are other people in the district feeling and what are they experiencing as well? What are you hearing from people?
I think everyone's just trying to get in there and get started, and barley's been the same sort of issue, just a bit difficult to harvest at the moment. I mean, we're 2 weeks early anyway, just because we had such a dry finish. But yeah, with this rain coming, I think everyone's just a bit worried. Everyone's very well prepared. I've never seen people so prepared for harvest, roads graded, machines out of the shed a month before harvest, ready to go. So everyone's done everything right, I think. You just can't control the rain, and we're just going to have to work around it. We usually just plug away with our own header, but we've got a contractor this year purely for that reason, just to get it off quickly. A lot of people have sort of developed on-farm storages, bunkers, grain sheds, put up silos just so they're not having to wait for trucks, because I know that'll be a bit of an issue. So, yeah, everyone's prepared, and the whole mindset is get the crop off, get it off as quick as you can, and worry about the grain later.
Are you excited at this point? How are you feeling? Are the nerves still there, particularly with the forecast that is ahead?
Very excited because, the crops are looking so good. But just wary, we're looking at this rain coming. Like, I remember 2010, I guess the difficulties it created. But then again, the yield's there. We're excited. And, whatever gets thrown at us, we've just got to deal with it.
Exactly. Is there a bit of a build-up of resilience and also gratitude of the position that we're in this year right now as compared to last season? Do you think that makes it a little bit easier to take?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's right. I mean, whatever gets thrown at us, at least we've got a crop to harvest, whether it be weather damaged or not. We've got something there and we've got a bloody good yield in front of us. So there's no one really complaining. The resilience is unbelievable.
Tom Cullen, who farms barley at Canamble, and he's hoping the rain stays away, as are many people in that region. It's coming up to 12 minutes to 1 on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, cowpea aphid has infested almost every loosened paddock on the Monero, according to local land services, and it's causing a real headache for farmers. The aphids can cause severe health problems for sheep. Farmers have lost ewes and lambs in the past few weeks. Joe Powells from local land services in Cooma says the outbreak is widespread and on a scale not seen before.
The issue certainly hasn't gone away for producers on the Monero. We're still seeing significant numbers of active aphids across loosened paddocks from north to south, east to west in the Monero region. Most people are varying their response and their management, but we're still seeing significant numbers, unfortunately. Some of the grazies that have been growing and grazing loosened for 30, 40 plus years, they're all saying that they've never seen anything like this before. They've dealt with aphids when the blue-green aphid first came through the region. It was something they had to manage. but this is a totally different aphid. And I guess we're just trying to reassure producers that, you know, they're not alone in this. Everyone has been affected. I'm yet to see a paddock of lucerne that doesn't have cowpea aphids in it. But now we've just got to manage the issue. You know, it's not something they're doing on their own.
What impact are you seeing that have on livestock?
Look, the effect on susceptible livestock is very significant still, particularly our sheep across the district. We're seeing severe photosensitization. We're seeing a lot of damage, I guess, around facial areas, ears, eyes, noses. Unfortunately, in lactating ewes, we're seeing significant damage to their udders, and still hearing of reporting of lamb losses, which is very unfortunate.
What are the most successful methods to reduce the impacts of photosensitization, but also to deal with the aphid problem?
Yeah, I guess there's two things that we have to address here. The first one is upfront the animal health issue. So certainly looking after the animals, getting them into shade and shelter and out of the direct sunlight is the most important thing that landholders can do at this point in time if they can. Providing them with an alternative source of feed, be that pasture elsewhere in the paddock or go back to hand feeding again, is certainly an option. And then the other side of the coin is actually dealing with the aphids themselves in the paddock. Some producers are having to go down the path of actually looking at spraying to remove the aphids. We are seeing some early signs of natural predators moving in, but unfortunately some producers just don't have the luxury of waiting for the natural predators to be there in significant enough numbers to make a difference. So we are starting to see some positive signs of predators, but in the meantime some producers are having to make more proactive decisions.
And what is it about this season in particular that's meant that there's been this outbreak of cowpea aphids?
We've unfortunately had the perfect storm as far as the environmental conditions have gone. We suspect the aphids probably first arrived in the district back in autumn. We had a fairly mild autumn. Winter has certainly kept them in check with the cold conditions and lots of frosts. But the recent weeks we've had really lovely sort of springtime conditions with some humidity and temperatures around that sort of 18 to 20 degrees, which is what the cowpea aphids absolutely love. We're not lucky to see a return to extremely hot weather, sort of, you know, 30, 35 degrees, where the aphids really struggle and start dying. So we're probably in for quite a few more weeks of perfect conditions for these aphids. We're really interested in hearing from producers from across the Monero who have been trying to manage these aphids, whether they've just got aphids on lucerne or whether they've experienced photosensitization as well. So we'd really like to hear from any landholders who have been affected. We're interested, I guess, in following up some of these animals over the short and long term to see if there's any animal health implications. And we're working with the veterinary team from local land services to make that happen.
Jo Powell's from the LLS in Cooma. She was speaking there to Josh Becker, and they're urging farmers to contact the local LLS office if you do see cowpea aphids in your paddocks. Apparently there's almost every lucerne paddock in the Monero has cowpea aphids in it at the moment. It's 7-1. Time for markets now. Let's go to Wodonga Cattle first up and Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. Wodonga agents yarded just over 1,000 cattle and quality was exceptional. With plenty of weight in the offering, prices eased back for veal 6 to 15 cents, 390 to 438. Trade steers were back 8, 397 to 415. Feeder steers eased back 5, 387 to 415. Feeder heifers, very few to quote, the medium weights 380 to 386. Trade heifers put on 4 cents, 370 to 415. Grown steers, 500 to 600 kilo, 380 to 415. Bullocks were up 2 cents, 360 to 390. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Let's go to Forbes Sheep and Lambs and Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers fell to 11,750 and included 6,700 new season lambs. The quality was good, but there are a few more dry skin new season lambs. Trade and heavyweights were both best supplied, with lightweights very limited. The market was firm, with only the extra heavy lambs slipping 6 to 8. New season trades 170 to 184, averaging 770. Heavy lambs 163 to 195 or 745 cents on average, with extra heavies 186 to 238. The old trade lambs were firm, lamb selling to 168, the heavy old lambs back 2 to 5, 167 to 198, and extra heavies reached 210. Merino trades 155 to 180. Mutton numbers halved and prices jumped $15 to $20. The medium weight ewes 149 to 160, heavy crossbred ewes 194 to 230, and merinos reached 236. And this has been Graham Richard at Forbes.
Let's go to Carcor Cattle now and David Monk.
Good afternoon. Numbers were similar for a yarding of 821. It was a fair quality yarding with reasonable numbers of prime cows and ground heifers. There were a few pens of ideal feeder cattle and prime ground steers, though the quality of the trade cattle was back. Not all the regular buyers were operating, with a couple of southern trade processors not buying. Young cattle of the trade were up to 14 cents cheaper, with prime veelers selling to 420. Prime steer yearling sold from 370 to 431, while the prime heifer yearling sold to 429. Feeder cattle were 10 cents dearer, with the feeder steers selling from 380 to 436, while the feeder heifers sold from 369 to 412. Young cattle of the restockers were around firm, with the young steers selling from 513 to 550. Ground steers were around firm, while the ground heifers were up to 12 cents cheaper. Ground steers sold from 320 to 380, while the prime ground heifers sold from 318 also to 380. Cows were 9 cents cheaper, with the three scores selling from 290 to 298. The prime heavyweight cows sold from 295 to 317 to average 312. Heavy bulls sold to 347. This is David Monk at CTLX for MLA.
To Gunnedah Cattle now and James Armitage.
Good afternoon. Numbers almost halved to a penning of 1,265 head. Yearlings and ground steers well supplied, a fair supply of cows. Quality and condition was mostly good. Limited supplies of lightweight stool cattle. The usual buyers in attendance. Trends varied through the young cattle. Quality a factor in price change. Lightweight yearlings sold to cheaper trends. Steers 417 to 449 cents a kilo. Plain condition heifers 300 to 540 cents. Medium and heavy yearling feeder steers were firm to a shade cheaper. Medium weights 358 to 443. Heavy feeders to 424. Similar trends to feeder heifers 358 to 418. The medium weights. Trade yearlings mostly firm. Heavy steers to 400 cents. Heifers sold from 340 to 418. Shop trade to 425. Heavy ground steers are up to 15 cents dearer, 360 to 400 cents. Heavy cows were slightly cheaper. They sold from 268 to 314 cents a kilo. James Armitage for MLA in Gunnedah.
To Inverell Cattle now, Doug Robson.
Good afternoon. Numbers were slightly dearer for yarding of 1130 head. Young cattle made up a large percentage of the yarding, while cow numbers were down. Quality was again good, with most cattle off crop. The market remained very strong, with feeder steers selling 3 to 4 cents dearer. Medium and heavy 380 to 422 cents, restockers up to 500. Feeder heifers were up to 10 cents dearer in places. They ranged from 363 to 416. Ground steers slightly dearer, 347 to 398. Feeders up to 400 cents. Ground heifers held firm, selling from 340 to 358. Cow market held firm. Three score medium weights averaged 294. Heavy cows sold from 304 to 315. Heavy bulls topped at 339 cents. Doug Robson at Inverell.
Let's go to Scone Cattle now and Neil Geddes.
Afternoon. Numbers lift for 570 fed of good quality cattle, mostly young cattle with a good fat cover. Around 80 prime condition heavy cows also penned. Younger cattle a little cheaper, cows and bulls firm. Veelers to the restockers 9 cents cheaper, steers 420 to 502 cents, heifers 400 to 488 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers to feed in the restockers 8 cents cheaper, medium weights 388 to 460, heavyweights 372 to 410 cents. Yearling heifers 5 to 8 cheaper, medium weights to feed in the restockers 368 to 424 cents. Prime condition young cattle to the butchers, lower yielding this week, prices eased accordingly, the best reached 428 cents. Heavyweight ground steers 4 cents dearer, 352 to 360 cents. Cows remain firm, the better covered heavyweights, some weighing over 800 kilograms, 290 to 318 cents. Heavy bulls firm, reaching 336 cents a kilogram. Neil Geddes, Scone Cattle for the MLA.
Thanks for that, Neil, and that's the market information for today.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Before we go, a couple more texts about the shearing issue, and Scooter's asking the question, are the contractors also looking for experience roustabouts and presses, etc.? I imagine that they are, Scooter, at the moment, considering this, the skill shortage. But Greg on the issue of shearing as well, is pointing out shearing is a skill which may take up to a couple of years to learn. Talking about those people that have gone through the training course, the 100 or so that have gone through the recent training course. Greg warns a lot of butchered sheep otherwise, if not carried out by a competent shearer. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour, and a reminder, of course, you can head to our Facebook page and check out the details and the conversations there. Head to Facebook and search for ABC Rural. We'll talk to you tomorrow between 12 and 1.